This is 1A. I'm John Donvan, host of Intelligence Squared US, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Salman Rushdie's books span continents and centuries and often blur the lines between magic and reality. But for his newest book, he gives us a heavy dose of realism smack dab in the middle of New York City. This book, his 13th, is called The Golden House, and it came out earlier this month. Congratulations, Salman Rushdie, on book number 13.
Thank you. Novel number 13. It's actually book number 18, but the others are nonfiction.
Welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear from you, too. What questions do you have for Salman Rushdie? And if you've read The Golden House so far, what do you think of it? Comment on our Facebook page, and our email address is 1A@WAMU.org. And I also want to note, if you're here in Washington, D.C., you can hear Salman Rushdie speak tonight at the 6th and I Synagogue. So, Salman Rushdie, born in India, raised and educated in the UK, you're now an American citizen.
Yep.
You write a lot about people who go from one place to another. But what I found interesting in The Golden House is that your narrator is, you don't explicitly ever say he's a native-born American.
But he sort of is.
But he is. From very, very young childhood. And he's a New Yorker.
Yes.
Also. And I'm curious, you came to the States about 20 years ago.
Yes.
Where's the point, what was the point at which you became confident enough in your grasp of this culture that you had now adopted, the second time you'd adopted a culture, that you could create a character who could speak in an American voice? By the way, you pull it off. I'm a New Yorker, too.
All right. Thank you. No, what I mean, I really waited a long time. In my books, which, as you say, they happen all over the place, but they've usually had central characters who are of South Asian origin or Indian origin. And certainly whenever there have been first-person narrators, they have been, from there. It was a decision to do it, and I'm glad you think I pulled it off. But I think, at this point, after 20 years, I'm part of the furniture in New York.
Yeah, you don't feel like a foreigner in New York. You feel
like
an American in New
York. I really don't. Actually, even though I've been living there for 20 years, I've known New York since I was in my early 20s, when I first came. So when I did make the move, I wasn't a stranger in town. I already knew the place pretty well. But it was a decision to have A, an American narrator, and B, somebody much, much younger than me.
Yeah, he's 25 years
old. He's just out of NYU film school, basically.
So his name is Rene, and this is one of those tricky things where we want to entice people about your book but can't give away the story. So the sort of rougher outlines. His name is Rene. He's a filmmaker, and he becomes intrigued by a family that moves into his neighborhood. His house basically backs up to a garden, and the other house backs up to the same communal garden.
Yeah.
He becomes interested in them. He becomes interested in making a film about them. So there's a little sense of story within a story. But as you say, he's 25 years old. So that was my other question to you is, not only did you become an American, but you went back in time some 30, 45 years in your case. Can a guy who's 70, well, obviously you're going to say yes, but how does a guy who is 70 capture the voice of a 25-year-old?
Well,
know so much that happened in between.
It's good to set yourself difficult tasks, And I mean, I think one of the answers to the question is that I've always had, like all my life, I've had friends in my circle of friends of a very wide age range. Like when I was 25, I had friends who were 65 and 70, and I've always liked that, to know people in many different walks of life, many different ages, many different ethnicities. And so because of that, I mean, I actually did, one of the reasons he ends up being a young filmmaker is that I actually do know a bunch of young filmmakers in downtown New York, sort of pretty much like him, and they gave me the voice. They gave me the way into his character, really.
And do you... On the authenticity of his youthful voice, do you fact check only yourself, or do you have other people who?
No. I got one of the things I did when I finished the book and long before it was published, is I had a group of people read it including much younger people, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't. Apart from anything else, you want to be sure that your ear is accurate, that you're not saying things that would, or you're not making him say things that would never come out of his mouth. Now, as it happens, he's slightly nerdy and old-fashioned, which helps. Yeah.
Did you, in fact, get notes that you needed to change this or that about the guy?
I didn't get anything significant. No, I didn't. I mean, one of the things I do always check, even after all this time in America, is sometimes I can slip up on Americanism versus Englishism, you know, Britishisms. Mm-hmm. And I always ask people to say, just if that phrase would not ever sit in an American mouth, you know, tell me. And I mean, there were two or three of those.
So the family he becomes interested in is mysterious, from another place, with a strange name. What's their story?
Well, first of all, their name is not their real name. I mean, that's this is an old patriarch in his early 70s at the beginning of the book, who we see, by the end of the book, he's pushing 80, and his three adult sons. And they have relocated to Greenwich Village in New York, from what quite rapidly it becomes clear is Bombay in India. But they want to conceal their past. They change their names. They refuse to say anything about where they came from. And they're trying to reinvent themselves from scratch, if you like. And I think the reader becomes aware quite clear, quite early, that something very big is being concealed. You know, mm-hmm. And Rene, the young filmmaker who's their neighbor, gets a kind of whiff of, what are all these secrets, you know? And he's a young man looking for a big subject, and he thinks that they might be his big subject. And so he sort of inveigles himself into their lives to find out. And as he finds out more about them, so do we. But then he makes a kind of almost fatal mistake, which is, you know, Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby had the intelligence never to become involved in the lives of Gatsby and Daisy and so on. He's always on the outside looking in. Whereas Rene makes the mistake of crossing that line and becoming much too mixed up in their lives. And that becomes a huge problem for him too.
As I said at the beginning, this is not a book that has magical qualities in quite the same way that some of your other novels have. But there are people certainly who believe in magic. And spirituality in the book. But what really anchors it, again, for somebody who's lived through the last 8 years, is that the book begins at the time when Barack Obama was inaugurated as president, and takes us through an election 8 years later with an unnamed candidate, whom you refer to as the Joker. Mm-hmm. And what I wonder about is, when did you finish? How did current events sort of in 2014, 2015 change the story you were already forming, since it really does seem to be the case that you wound up affected retrospectively by the Trump Clinton race?
Well, you know, most of the book was basically written by election day. Mm-hmm. So I guess I guessed right. You know, or to put it even more strangely, the book guessed right, because I myself, having voted on that day, was hoping for the other result, you know, but in the writing of the book, the logic of the book seemed to lead towards what actually did happen. And I mean, it had always been my plan to write right up against the present moment, you know, to write a book which was about the exact moment in which the book was being written. And so as the campaign developed, it seemed it would be absurd not to have some mention of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's in there. But I mean, I think of it very much as the background context against which the story plays itself out, rather than being about that. You know? I mean, one of the great inspirations for me in this book and many other books is the work of Charles Dickens. And one of the things I really love about Dickens is that he will have this super realistic background, you know, where everything is checked and accurate. The kind of shoelaces in people's boots, you know, are worked out. But against this hyper realist world, he projects these characters who are kind of operatic and larger than life. And we buy them because they are so deeply rooted in the real, you know. So I thought, do that. Try and have as realistically contemporary a background, a social milieu, as I can create. And then these characters who are a bit sort of grand, even in their own opinion of themselves, Nero Golden and his family. You know, somebody who takes the name Nero Golden mm-hmm. is not a modest man, you know, and has a high opinion of himself. So these slightly operatic characters, you know, are the main characters in the book, but the world in which they're set is as real as I can make it.
Speaking of contemporary issues, just before you came on, we were talking with Nick Dirks of a professor at UC Berkeley, until recently chancellor, about this issue of free speech on campus. And you're so associated with your personal story with the issue of speech and freedom of speech. And if anybody out there doesn't know it, Salman Rushdie, for his book in the late 1980s, Satanic Verses, drew the ire of Ayatollah Khomeini, who put a death threat on your life, forced you into hiding for a decade. That period seems to have ended with some tortuous ambiguity to it, but you're out here now, and you have been, you're an absolutist on free speech, probably were before that, but more so now. People want to hear you talk about that because of the experience you went through. And you've also been teaching on U.S. campuses at NYU and Emory. Do you hear this conversation? Do you have a place? Do you have something to say in this conversation?
Well, I mean, look, I know Nick Dirks quite well because I knew him when he was at Columbia University in New York. And I was listening to what he had to say, and I'm broadly speaking, in sympathy with that. I think in this particular case, Berkeley was perfectly willing to guarantee the rights of all kinds of people to express themselves. And what has happened there in recent weeks, I think, is a series of stunts both from the left and the right, you know, both from people like Milo Yiannopoulos and from that kind of Antifa people who have been mistreating the campus, which I think has tried very hard to be a space in which all kinds of thought can be expressed. I mean, I think, you know, when I'm thinking about free speech right now, I'm thinking a great deal more about what the president has been saying about the NFL and the NBA, and that seems to me to be much more of an assault on free speech. And I'm interested to see how strongly the response, both the athletes and the owners in the NFL have responded, and so they should.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to 1A. Do you think there's such a thing as hate speech, speech that should be called hate speech, and does that put it in a separate category of prohibitiveness?
You know, this is a thing on which I've changed my mind, because when I was living in England, they draw the line slightly differently, you know, than here. In England, there's a thing called the Race Relations Act, and if you make racist statements, if you infringe the Race Relations Act, you can be prosecuted and sent to jail theoretically. You know, so the free speech line is.
What would be a violation of that act, for example?
Well, you know, a statement by the Ku Klux Klan, or indeed carrying a Nazi flag down the streets of Charlottesville, that would be on the wrong side of the Race Relations Act in England.
You could go to jail for that.
You could do, yes, and when I was living in England, I really thought, well, what's wrong with that? I don't see any problem with that, you know. Since I've been living here in the States, I've thought a great deal about the First Amendment's much wider definition of free expression, you know, and I've come to the conclusion, not without reservations, that the First Amendment position is actually a better position, because I actually want to know where the racists are, you know, and I don't think that you get rid of a reprehensible idea by banning it. I think in some ways you glorify it, you glamorize it, but you give it the kind of power of taboo, you know. And so, I mean, I was interested that even Justice Scalia, no liberal, defended flag burning as being a First Amendment right, you know. And I think if flag burning is a First Amendment right, so is carrying a Nazi flag, unfortunately.
But you said you have that position now with reservations. What are the reservations?
Well, because, you know, what it can end up in with is what happened in Charlottesville, which is people running people over in their car. You know, it becomes an act of violence, and that's where the border is. You know, how do you protect the right of expression while also protecting people's safety? So, as I say, I do come down on the First Amendment side, but I have difficulties with it sometimes.
And that required being in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really coming to America and becoming involved in free speech issues over here, becoming involved with Penn American Center, which I was president of for a while, and you know, the ACLU and all organizations like that that made me think again about this issue and come to the conclusion that where America draws the line is actually on balance better than where the British do it.
You've brought up Donald Trump, you feel, as a threat to free speech in the kind of thing he's talking about over the weekend on the NFL. Interestingly, a lot of reviewers have seen parallels between your character, Nero Golden, and Donald Trump. Yeah, they're both wealthy guys who put their names on their properties, and they have mysterious associates.
Yes, they're both real estate people who have beautiful Eastern European wives.
Yeah.
There's that, too. But
was that accidental? Because
I mean, it was partly accidental. Yeah. I mean, some of it was accidental. Because, you know, when it turns out that he comes from Mumbai, I mean, it's not unusual for billionaires in that city to be involved in the real estate business because it's growing so fast. Mm-hmm. So that was just an accident because I had been writing. I had Nero Golden in my head for 8 or 9 years, you know, before this novel started getting written. Some of it's accidental, some of it is satirically intended, but one of the big differences, I think, is that I like Nero Golden. You know, that he starts off, I think, in the novel, you see him as a kind of frightening figure. You know, you see him as dark and menacing. And as the book goes on, I think, and as the tragedy of his life unfolds, I think the reader gets much more compassion for him. You know, and I think by the time you get to the end of the book, you feel much more kindly towards him than at the beginning. So I think it's true that when the book begins, people will hear a few echoes of another real estate developer. You know, but as the moment the character takes hold and, you know, starts unfolding, I think he becomes very, very different.
Plus, there's this other character, Joker, who more closely resembles and is running for president.
He's running for president. Well, you know, what I did think is that in a deck of playing cards, the two most unusual playing cards are the Joker and the Trump. You know, those are the two cards that don't behave like the other cards. And so I thought, well, I don't want to have Trump in the book, so I'll have the other one.
All right, thanks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about your early days working in advertising, mm-hmm. which I just find fascinating. And I'm going to see if there's hope for everybody who's working in advertising who wants to write novels, to see if there's some inspiration from there. So after that, we'll be continuing our conversation with author Salman Rushdie, his new book, The Golden House. This is 1A. I'm John Donvan. Welcome back to 1A. I'm John Donvan. We are talking with Salman Rushdie about his newest book, The Golden House. And as I mentioned before the break, I was fascinated a while back to learn that earlier in your career, back in the 1970s as a young man, you were, while working on your first novel, you had another job.
Yeah, I had no money, so I had to pay the rent. So I got a job writing advertising copy. Most of the time for the agency Ogilvy & Mather, which is sort of transatlantic anyway, but I was in the London office. And yeah, I mean, it was very interesting in a couple of ways. First of all, I did it mostly part-time and was able to work half the week and work in advertising the other half. And that's how I wrote Midnight's Children. But I got to meet an enormous number of other creative people who were using advertising in the same kind of part-time way.
Like all those British directors.
Like all those, yeah. I mean, I made a hair care commercial with Nicholas Roeg.
Wow.
You know, I was responsible for, I think, the first commercial that John Cleese was ever in at the moment of Monty Python, you know. It was an extraordinary moment in advertising because a lot of people who grew up to be a great generation of British film directors were making beef burger commercials, you know. So, yeah. So there's, you know, Ridley Scott, Tony Scott, Hugh Hudson, all these people, Nick Rogue, you know, were working like me part time in advertising, and so that was fun. But the great thing, I think, in many ways, the greatest thing it did for me was send me to America for the first time. Because I got a job for what used to be called the United States Travel Service, which you know, which used to run ad campaigns to get people to take their vacations in the United States. And when I got the account, I had never been to the United States. So they said, well, you better go. And they sent me on the American government's dime, you know, all nice. Over America. And that's how I went to L.A. and San Francisco and Las Vegas and here in D.C. and New York. It was the first time I'd ever visited. And so, yes, advertising introduced me to the USA.
At the time that you were working in advertising, were you holding your nose doing the advertising? So that was it seen as an awful and arduous and lowbrow and horrible, so that you could write because you needed yes. money, or did you actually get into it?
Well, some of each. You know, I mean, certainly there was it. You know, nowadays advertising is kind of cool, and people watching football on TV think the commercials of the Super Bowl are cooler than the show sometimes. But it wasn't like that then. It was considered to be not the right thing to be doing if you wanted to be a serious writer. But there were a lot of serious writers doing it. You know, I mean, where I worked at Ogilvy's, there were the novelist Faye Weldon was there when I was there. And in America, I discovered a lot of major writers had started off in advertising, like Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a PhD thesis waiting to be written, you know, the influence of advertising on contemporary literature. But the thing that I enjoyed was learning how to make films. I used to make commercials for a newspaper, for the Daily Mirror newspaper. And if you're making three commercials a week, every week, you learn everything there is to know about filmmaking at very, very high speed.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, it's not frightening to you. You know, you can do it.
Were you glad to leave it behind?
Yes, that's true. I mean, when Midnight's Children came out, which was in the spring of 1981, I thought I had a bit of money finally from my writing, and I thought I have to back myself, and take the jump. They didn't believe I was leaving. They thought I was negotiating for a raise. And right up until the day that I left, they thought I was playing some complicated game of chicken. But having said that, when the book went on to be successful and when it won the Booker and so on, the Booker Prize, we had these things called telegrams. The first telegram I received was from my old boss at the ad agency. And what he said was, congratulations, one of us made it.
That's lovely.
It's very sweet.
Well, so to all of those people out there who are working in IT and in advertising and other places who want to be writers. And I kind of believe everybody at some level yes. wants to be a writer. Yes. Your advice would be, stick to your day
yeah.
job? Or
no, I think you might get lucky, you know. It's true that when I was working in it, that more or less everyone in the creative department had something in their bottom drawer, you know, whether it was a TV treatment or a movie screenplay or an idea for a novel, or everybody was hoping to go on to something else. And as I say, many of the people making commercials did go on very, very gloriously to great careers, And so it does happen. It does happen. Not often, though.
Of course, today people can have platforms they can use that didn't exist 40 years ago. They can self-publish, they can tweet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We checked on your Twitter feed, actually, and the last tweet you sent was the day that you went to vote for Hillary Clinton.
It's election day.
You said, I'm going to vote for Hillary now.
Yeah.
Close
no,
to
I,
that?
No, I actually just came out, had just voted. I posted a photograph of myself having just, with my little badge on, saying I voted. And then I just stopped. I mean, the truth is I had been thinking of stopping for a while, because I think the atmosphere on Twitter just changed into something less attractive. You know, there were a lot more bullying, a lot more trolling, the kind of lynch mob atmosphere that began to happen on Twitter. And I just thought, I don't like this environment, And
so did you for a while? Were you into it for
yes,
a while?
Yes, when I first started, a friend of mine said, you should try it, you might like it. And I did like it, And I enjoyed being able to talk to a large number of people interested in my writing, talk directly to readers in that way. Yeah, I had fun for a while. I wrote a limerick about Kim Kardashian, which I will not repeat, etc. So I was having fun for a while, and then I stopped having fun. And I don't know whether it's that my attitude changed or whether it actually changed, whether the platform became rather different, you know. And I just thought, I don't want this noise in my head. And so I quit. I deleted the app.
You're at NYU now, and you were at Emory. What do you teach?
Well, now at Emory, I taught a whole range of different things because I was there over the course of 10 years, and it changed. But now at NYU, I'm actually, some people might think unusually, in the journalism school, because I devised a course in creative nonfiction. I mean, I thought one of the interesting things that's happened in the last, let's say, half century, ever since the birth of new journalism with people like George Plimpton and Tom Wolfe and Lillian Ross and so on, there's been this very interesting development of nonfiction which uses the techniques of the novel in order to tell true stories, you know, and some of the most interesting books of our time are of that kind. You know, I'm thinking of books like Schindler's List, you know, or In Cold Blood, mm-hmm. Or more recently the work of the Nobel laureate Svetlana Alexievich, her book about Chernobyl, for example. And I just thought it was very. The course is called Journalism as Literature, and the question is, can it be? And if so, what happens when the journalist adds little touches which may not be entirely factual? You know, one of the books that I teach is Kapuscinski's wonderful book about Haile Selassie, The Emperor, which is wonderful as writing and wonderful as a piece of imagination. But the more you start looking at it, there's a lot of it that is suspect, mm-hmm. you know, as reportage. So it's just...
And it's required. It's required that it be factual.
Yes.
I mean, that's part of the compact with the reader.
Yes, because it's journalism. You know, and the students, I mean, I teach a graduate seminar, and the students are very purist about this. You know, they know that reportage is based on fact, and it needs to be, you know. So, but it makes it an interesting argument about when work exists on this boundary between the literary and the journalistic, you know, how much are you allowed to do? What is legitimate and what's not legitimate, etc. Anyway, it's fun to teach.
I remember reading the book Seabiscuit about 15, 20 years ago, which is an account of a true story and claims to be truly factual. But I remember reading a sentence, a woman gets out of a car and the breeze lifts her dress in 1937. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how can the author know that? The author I have a lot of respect for, by the way. But I think the answer is that she looked up the weather report that day and made it plausible.
Yes. And I mean, there's things like that which are impressive. Like when I was teaching Tom Wolfe's book, Radical Chic, about Leonard Bernstein's party for the Black Panthers back in the day, there's a moment at which, first of all, we know that Leonard Bernstein did not grant Wolfe an interview. So he had no interview with him. And yet there's a moment at the beginning of the book when he describes a dream that Bernstein had of a large black man rising up from behind the piano in his apartment and scaring him. And I thought, how does Tom Wolfe know this? You know, he's never talked to him. Mm-hmm. And actually one of my students answered the question by having done some homework and found an interview with Bernstein from somewhere else in which he had talked about that dream. You know, so
Bernstein was the source after all.
Was the source after all. And there was a source. So it wasn't made up.
How do you teach writing? Are you teaching writing?
No, I'm not. I'm teaching books. I mean, when I was offered the job by NYU, I said the only thing I don't want to teach is creative writing. And they said, well, that's lucky because the only thing we don't want you to teach is creative writing. I mean, I worry about it. I have taught it. What you can teach is craft. You can teach technique. You know, you can teach people how to be better than they are in terms of their control of language and style and form. What I fear is that you can't teach the things that really make an artist. You know, I think a real writer has a voice of his own. You know, that if you read a novel by Charles Dickens or Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know it's them. You know, Hemingway, you know it's him. You know, that you can't teach. And you can't really teach the eye. You know, the most good writers have a very sharp eye for how people behave, what they wear, how they speak, and a very sharp ear. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things, you can improve them, sure. You can improve them, but you can't give them to people. You know, you can't if they don't have them to begin with. So yeah, you can improve the craft, but if there isn't the thing there in the first place, it's very hard.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to 1A. So you've never taught creative writing or attempted to teach creative writing?
Not in any sustained way. I've done odd classes in it.
And as a student yourself, nobody taught you to be a creative writer?
I never studied literature at all. I mean, my subject at Cambridge was history. And I actually think that that was a great blessing for me, because the kinds of books that I've gone on to write have had are very interested in the historical and how public life, how public events intersect with private lives, and what can we do? Can we change the world by our actions, or does the world simply change us? And that subject is one of the great subjects of history, and I think it was useful for me to have been taught that. I think even in the Golden House, there's an attempt to create a very contemporary history of America at this moment, and in a way it's breaking a rule, because many times you're told that you shouldn't write right up against the present moment. You should wait until you have some distance and perspective.
In history?
No, in history, but also in literature, So I thought I was going to try and do this risky thing, because if you do it wrong, then the book becomes valueless almost immediately, like yesterday's newspapers, And if you do it right, then you perhaps capture a moment for all time. And it's a gamble, and it's a dangerous thing to do, creatively dangerous thing to do. But I thought that's what I would try and do.
You have two characters, the sons of Nero Golden, who have their own challenges with identity and interaction with society. One of them is struggling with gender identity, and the other one has autism. And I'm curious to know what kind of research you did on the character with autism. The reason for that is I actually know a lot about autism, and written about it. And one of the issues in autism now is who gets to speak for autistic people, particularly people who are more capable of independence and powerful language, some of whom are beginning to take the position that stories about people with autism should only be written by people with autism. I'm guessing you would challenge that.
Well, I would challenge that first of all, what I wouldn't challenge is that it's very important to try and know as much as you can and to get it right, and not to be an idiot about it, but I would challenge that assertion about any group, if you extend that assertion, it means only women can write about women, and only children can write about children, and it's just not tenable. It destroys literature. What I do think is that you have to make your best effort and then be judged by what you've done, my point of entry into that particular subject was that one of my very close friends has had an autistic child who I've been very close to all his life. I mean, now he's grown up, he's in his late 20s now, but I've literally known him all his life, and I'm very, very fond of him and close to him. And so that gave me a point of entry, if you like, a kind of a point of emotional sympathy. And then I thought, just find out as much as you can. So I did.
Your friend's child, who's now an adult, can speak like the character in the book can speak.
He's kind of he's very gifted. He's working. Actually, he's working as an actor in television now. In Britain, and doing very well. But it's been a bumpy ride, I think, both for him and for his family.
We only have about a minute and a half left, but before you go, I want to mention that folks can see you on television pretty soon. Are you allowed to talk about that?
I'm not allowed to talk about it, but you are.
Curb your enthusiasm.
I have no comment to make.
Apparently, you'll be making an appearance in the return of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
It's a filthy rumor.
Well, you can talk about your book, so... Yeah, I think it's a rumor that can be confirmed that you'll be appearing in a cameo role in Curb Your Enthusiasm, maybe even bigger than that. Well, Salman Rushdie, your book is The Golden House. I want to let people know again, if you're in Washington, D.C., you're speaking tonight at 6th and I, and you can buy the book wherever books are sold. And remember to send us your stories about everything and anything. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Joshua Johnson is back tomorrow. Salman Rushdie, thanks so much for joining us on 1A.
Thank you.
Until we meet again, thanks. This is John Donvan, and this is 1A.